Thank you very much, John. You've told us a lot about the reforms that have been set in motion since you became Speaker, both procedurally and in engaging with the public, and I think given us a sense of the trajectory of where you want to go. We have a short time for questions. I'd quite like to hear some comments from the younger colleagues in this room about what they think a 21st century Parliament should look like. Just so we can kind of stress test the vision that we've had from Mr. Speaker to see if he's got it right. So we'll take a few questions from the audience. Please do signal if you'd like to ask one, and the Speaker will respond.
Usually takes one person to kick it off.
At the back there, or in the middle.
Yes.
Can you shout up, please?
Sorry, would you agree that there's a failure in democracy where it's only really a small portion of voters, that's swing voters in swing seats, that will make any difference to the makeup of a parliament in future, I suppose?
Sorry, do I think it's fatal for democracy?
Do you think it's a failure of democracy that only swing voters in swing seats will make a very large difference in the makeup of the next parliament?
I don't think that of itself is a failure of democracy. I think that there are different models of democracy, and what essentially you're flagging up is the question of the electoral system. Should we have the system of first past the post for Westminster elections, or should there be some kind of proportional system or the alternative vote system? I think what I would say is that as far as Westminster elections are concerned, we've had that debate. We had it over the last couple of years, and the referendum voted no to the alternative vote. And so Nick Clegg, who was an advocate of that, and ideally an advocate of a properly proportional system, as he would say it, has accepted the verdict. You know, that you can't have a sort of rolling series of referenda on an issue. You can have a referendum, there's nothing to stop you having another one 10, 15, 20 years later, but you can't realistically keep having the same referendum over and again. Do I think that, you know, this is really bad news? I don't. I think there are arguments to be made for first past the post, and arguments for electoral reform. And I would, as Speaker, have had to rest content with whatever the electorate had decided. But do I think it sort of is a great sign of weakness in our system? No, I don't. I think you have to have a means by which to decide what is going to emerge as the government of the country. And generally speaking, the system in Westminster has produced a clear result, usually a majority government. Now, obviously, it didn't 2 years ago. It produced a hung parliament, but from which a coalition has emerged. I think that the democratic process is about much more than the result of the election. I think it's also about what happens locally in terms of the interaction between the voter and the person elected. And one thing, colleagues, I always try to bear in mind, because I think it's very key to our duty, is that being a member of parliament isn't just or mainly about doing what those who voted for you tell you to do. It's about trying to represent and stand up for the interests of your community as a whole. And it would be absolutely wrong for me ever at a surgery to ask someone whether they voted for me. I've never done so. I'm sometimes struck by the fact that people write to me and at the end of their letter they say, "I voted for you last year," or brackets, "member of the Buckingham Conservative Association," or whatever. I suppose it's their way of saying, "Well, we supported you, so we hope you'll now support us." But actually, whether somebody voted for me or not is neither here nor there to the effort that I make to try to help that person with his or her problem, or to ensure that his or her opinion can be put forward at the highest levels of government. So I think there are many weaknesses in our democracy, but if you're asking me, do I think that the electoral system is our major weakness, or a notable weakness by comparison with other challenges we face, the honest answer is no.
Okay, thank you. I think your next door neighbour was signalling she wanted to ask a question. No, she's withdrawn that wish.
She may resuscitate it.
I see you. I'm going to try and get some of the younger views in. And we've got one just there in the red jumper. Thank you.
You mentioned your outreach programme in education and trying to get young people more involved. Do you think that that's enough to get, you know, an A-level student to be interested in politics? So, yes, there are people here who have taken up A-level politics, but how many of them actually want to be politicians to change it? Is young people's involvement not more important in a 21st century British Parliament?
Yes, it's about a lot more effective and successful outreach than just getting to people who are studying politics A-level or studying politics at university. You're right. In other words, if you're asking me, do I rest content or would I rest content with that as an achievement, the answer is no. But you have, colleagues, to start somewhere. And if the level of interest in formal politics is low, you've got to think to yourself, well, how can I take a lead in trying to combat that problem? And I start by getting round to schools and colleges and universities. I must say to you that I do often say to schools, given the choice, I'd rather address the school as a whole or the sixth form as a whole. I remember once going to a school where, with the best of intentions, they had very specifically said, well, Mr. Speaker, we'll just address the A-level politics students. And although when I got there I was happy to do it, I thought it was actually a bit of a missed opportunity because, like you in a sense, I thought, ah, well, here I'm reaching the people who are already interested to an extent. And although I welcome that, and it's great to see so many young faces here, it's actually good if I can meet, and the Lord Speaker can meet, speak to and hear from people who are perhaps not studying A-level politics. I remember once going to meet a very hard-to-reach group of young people in Newcastle about 18 months ago on a day trip to the northeast, and I met people from very, very, very disadvantaged communities, out of work, NEETs, not in education, employment or training, often from not just disadvantaged backgrounds but very, very troubled backgrounds, who were very, very cynical, understandably, completely disengaged. And I had to try to say to them why it's worthwhile living in a democracy and how it can be meaningful to engage with the political process. So, no, I certainly don't regard it as good enough just to go to a group of A-level politics students or to go and speak to politics students at a university. I'm keen to try to engage much more widely than that. Physically, I can only do so much myself. We've got to use technology to get into schools. I don't want to get involved in a row with the government about citizenship education. But I would just like to make one point. Professor Matthew Flinders is currently working on developing a parliamentary studies module to the degree course that he runs at his university at Sheffield, and that's great. One thing I feel very strongly about is that as part of good citizenship in the United States, high school students are taught about the basic features of the American Constitution. And I think it's a weakness that in Britain we don't teach in schools, not party politics, I'm not asking for that, we don't teach people the basic elements of our politics and political way of life. Do you know, I meet a lot of people, including very distinguished, successful people in business and so on, who talk about government and parliament as though they're the same thing. How many people amongst the students in this audience know that in parliament, in the House of Commons, there are 650 MPs, of whom about 100 max, absolute maximum, are part of the government payroll vote. They're either ministers or parliamentary aides to ministers. About 100. 550 MPs are not members of the government at all. I often have even constituents who say, Mr. Speaker, given your role in the government, can you do X or Y? And I don't want to be like fussy and pedantic, but I often have to say to people, just hold on a moment. I'm not a member of the government. In fact, the one thing the Speaker absolutely isn't is a member of the government. The role of the Speaker is to stand up for the rights of Parliament, and sometimes that even involves irritating the government, perish the thought. So be it.
We're a little pressed for time, so time for one more short and last question. I'm going to be terribly ageist today and allow this young man at the front. Thank you.
How important is it for a 21st century democracy to represent its electorate demographically?
I think it's very important for Parliament to represent the makeup of the country as it is. I don't mean by that that you have to have absolute statistical equality so that, you know, if women are 52% of the population, 52% of MPs have to be women, likewise with ethnic minorities or people with disabilities. I wouldn't argue it as rigidly as that. But I do think, just commonsensically, I say to you, ladies and gentlemen, students, surely it must make sense for Parliament to look and sound a bit more like the Parliament of the country, a bit more like the country that we seek to represent and to govern. And that's where I think some of the critics get completely carried away.
in abusing the idea that we should try to get more women and more ethnic minorities, and they go on about political correctness, whatever that means, which just seems to me to be a term of abuse. If it's politically correct to try to ensure that we've got more women in Parliament, well, then I'm all for that. Our debates are improved. It's not just a question of putting bums on seats. The quality of debates on carers, on domestic violence, on child and human trafficking, on the state of the health service, on the special needs provision for children and young people who require such provision, those debates are much better quality now that we've got more women in Parliament. Our debates on inner city politics, on disengaged communities, on marginalised people, on race relations and so on, are better for having more members of the ethnic minorities in Parliament. So, you know, the short answer is I regard it as important and we've got more to do. And the chairman is rightly authoritarian on these matters, in my interest, because I have to catch a flight. But it would be discourteous of me not to take the last question.
Thank you very much. 10 years ago, the House of Lords debated the House of Lords reform again. They had 5 options on the ballot paper, and they decided, oh dear, this is terrible. And so they had to take 5 majority votes, and they lost the lot, and they then said there was a crisis. So Robin Cook tried to introduce preference voting. This is decision-making. It's nothing to do with elections. He tried to introduce preference voting into the Parliament, into Westminster, and it was thrown out. And he said, on reflection, because this would have required the technology of a paper and a piece of pencil, pencil and a piece of paper, which was far too advanced for this medieval parliament. At about the same time, I tried to persuade...
What's the question?
About the same time, I tried to persuade Belfast City Council that they could become the first democratically elected chamber in the world to use electronic preference voting when the time comes. At the time, the only pieces of modern technology they had in the debating chamber were the light bulb and the microphone. Is there any chance that when you say embrace modern technology, that Westminster might introduce electronic preference voting for those occasions when there are more than 2 options on the table?
It might, is the short answer to that. You deserve an answer. It might. Would I stand in the way of it? No. Do I have a problem with the idea of electronic voting, particularly in the circumstances you describe? I absolutely don't. I think you'll understand, ladies and gentlemen, when I say I don't think it's for me to try to drive a decision like that on which MPs individually will eventually have to cast their own votes. But would I be an obstacle to it being debated and decided? No. I would be happy for the House to decide whether to move towards electronic voting. If they want to, they won't find me an obstacle. Just as if the House wants to debate modes of address, do we keep Right Honourable Gentleman, Honourable and Learned Gentleman, the Honourable Lady, or do we move towards a system whereby we say Sylvia Hicks from West Belfast argued? Again, I'm not stuck in the past. I'm not wedded to a particular model. My attitude is let the House discuss and decide these matters, including the matter that you very properly raise.
Thank you very much. Let me come back to thank Mr. Speaker in a moment. But first of all, to offer a few final words of this conference. I think I can say on behalf of all those who've come here from Northern Ireland, the rest of the UK, beyond, that we've really enjoyed the warmth of the welcome that we've had wherever we've been in this city. I think we've enjoyed the inspiration of the city as a place for thinking about politics, about conflict, about how we're governed. We were here in 1992 for the PSA annual conference when this place was in conflict. We were here in 1997 when this place was emerging from conflict. Now we're here at a time when the institutions of government in Northern Ireland have some real stability and resilience. And I think that the vibrancy, the history of that setting has much to do with the vibrancy of the conference that we've had. Many thanks to all concerned. Thanks to the students who've come this afternoon. I think that's been a very special feature of the conference. Thanks to Cathy Paul and the team at the University of Ulster, which has helped to organise it, and to the PSA office team, Helena, Sandra, Louise. Thanks also, if you could pass this on, Cathy, to the staff of the Europa Hotel, who've been great. finally, thanks to our special guest, I think he's given us a story of this trajectory, which I think generally we would applaud, of making the House of Commons a more open, a more welcoming, a more relevant place. And he's spoken about that with passion and I think with great interest for our audience this afternoon. So thank you very much, John.